You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN, LPFM Radio, 106.9, Salida, Colorado. We're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and Truth Quest programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. My co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, a professor of geography at California State University at Stanislaus. With nearly 30 years of teaching experience, his academic research has focused on using ancient soils, paleosols, and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And our special guest this evening, for whom I'll let Dr. Carlstrom introduce, is Don Easterbrook.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to introduce and welcome Dr. Don Easterbrook to our program. It's a real pleasure to have him here with us. He's a real expert on the subject of past climates, and I think to some extent also present and future climates. Let me begin with a little introduction to him here. Dr. Don J. Easterbrook is Emeritus Professor of Geology at Western Washington University, where he has conducted research on global climate change in Western North America, New Zealand, Argentina, and various other parts of the world for the past 48 years. He has written 3 textbooks and several other books, about 150 papers in professional journals, and has presented 30 research papers at international meetings in 12 countries. All of his research has been funded by the National Science Foundation and other U.S. government agencies. His research includes causes of abrupt global climate changes during and following the last ice age, relationship of cosmogenic isotopes in ice cores to climate change, the relationship of the approximately 30-year warming and cooling phases to modern global warming, and predictions of global climate change for the next century. Dr. Easterbrook is past president of the Quaternary Geology and Geology Division of the Geological Society of America, chairman of the 1977 National Geological Society of America meeting, U.S. representative to the United Nations International Geological Correlation Program, associate editor of the Geological Society of America Bulletin for 15 years, and director of field excursions for the 2003 International Quaternary Association Congress. He has been featured in 2 New York Times articles on global warming, March 2007 and March 2009, and has appeared on national network shows at MSNBC, CNN, CBS, and Fox. A full resume is available at his website, which I'll give right now, just in case people want to refer to that website as we have our interview here. He has a lot of information on this website. It is the best one would be myweb.ww.edu/dbunny/. Is that correct, Don?
That's right.
For your website? Yeah. In fact, I would invite our listeners, and which I think will probably include some of my students in the near future, to go to Don's website. As we make these discussions, they'll have some very interesting, colorful graphs, figures to refer to as well. Is that the correct website address, Don?
It is. You can go directly to the climate change part of that website by going to myweb, M-Y-W-E-B dot W-W-U dot E-D-U slash D-B-U-N-N-Y slash research slash global slash index dot H-T-M. Or an easier way to do it is just to Google Don Easterbrook Global Warming, and the first listing there that will pop up will be my website. You just click on that and you go right to it.
I was figuring that might be the case.
So again, to get on this website,
an easy way, hard way.
just Google Don Easterbrook and then go to his website. Well, Don, you have been working in the area of climate change, climate research for your entire career, as I understand it. You've done a lot of work on the glacial history of the Cascade area, which is in your backyard since you taught at Western Washington University. So you've watched this whole man-caused global warming issue coming down the railroad tracks like a big slow-moving train, I'm sure, as I have as well. Most Americans, or most people, and many people in the world now, are firmly convinced that the Earth is warming and that it's our fault. It's because we're using fossil fuels. But your research does not support that, does it?
No, the geologic research that I've done has resulted in accumulation of a lot of data, and this data includes fluctuations of glaciers all over the world in response to climate change. Glaciers are really sort of a paleothermometer. When it's warm, they retreat. When it's cold, they advance. And also including isotope work in the Greenland ice cores, which leaves a record of temperature in the ice that we can read by looking at the isotopes of oxygen. And also a lot of other proxies for climate change that leave a fingerprint, so to speak, in a geologic record that we can read. And what's abundantly clear is that there's no doubt that there's been global warming for the last 25 years. But that doesn't prove anything. I mean, the fact that there was some global warming for 30 years and there was an increase in CO2 doesn't mean anything, because for the first 30 years after CO2 started to soar after World War II, we had 30 years of global cooling, just the opposite. And my research has turned up 40 phases of global warming and cooling in the last 500 years alone. So there's nothing unusual at all about global warming. It doesn't prove anything about global the cause of global warming by CO2. I mean, hell, I had hair before global warming, and does that prove that my loss of hair caused global warming or vice versa? No, there's no relationship. So anyway, the short answer to the whole thing is it has nothing to do with science. It's all about politics, power, and money.
Okay. We have, Melody and I have had the opportunity to interview Dr. Tim Ball of Canada, and I think he comes to the same conclusion that the science has been corrupted and perverted and hijacked more or less by a political agenda. So perhaps this is a logical breakdown for us. We can look at both of those issues. But as somebody who's interested in climate change and quaternary climates, in a way, in a kind of a strange way, this whole political issue gives people like you and myself an opportunity to come forward and try to educate people to what actually has been learned about past climates. So maybe we should start with that. You say you've looking at the Greenland ice cores, you see evidence for repeated 30-year cycles of warming and cooling, go back 500 years, and that we're essentially in that now. We've warmed up until about 1999, between about 1970 and 99, and now we're cooling. So do we see any influence of human activity at all?
There's no correlation with human activity whatsoever. And just as an example, I'll give you two stories, one about the last century and another about the 500 years. And if we can go back, clear back to 15,000 years, and you'll be amazed at the climate changes that have occurred in the past with no possible influence of CO2 at all, that are way, way more intense than what we've been seeing in the last 22 years or so. For anybody who's following along on the website, if you were to go back to the homepage where it says climate changes, the sheet that, or the page that deals with climate changes, and click on glacial fluctuations past climate changes with no change in CO2, which is an icon in the middle, There are some interesting graphs in there which relate to what I'm going to be giving you a verbal picture of. So in the last century, we've had four climate changes, not just one, but four. From 1880 actually until about 1915, we had geologic cooling, and the cooling that took place was record-setting in that most of the temperature records for cold were set during that period. That is the recorded, observed periods of cooling. And then in 1915, it started to warm up, and it warmed up until 1945. And in fact, the warmest year of this century was not in the past decade, but was in 1934. The 1930s were actually just slightly warmer than what we have right now, so there's nothing unusual. And this happened before the big increase in atmospheric CO2, so you can't blame this warming on CO2. And that's acknowledged even by the people who were pushing CO2. And then in 1945, there was a climate change to global cooling. I mean, global cooling from 1945 to 1977 at a time when CO2 in the atmosphere was soaring. So instead of producing warming, it produced 30 years of global, it didn't produce it, but it went hand in hand with 30 years of global cooling. Again, which shows that CO2 had no influence whatsoever on the global temperature. And then in 1977, there was what's called the Great Climate Shift, where the temperatures in the oceans flipped abruptly from their cool mode to the warm mode. And that started what is now generally referred to as the recent global warming period. So 1977 to 1999, there was indeed global warming, no doubt about it. No big deal. It had already happened in the 30s without CO2, and it had happened lots of times before that. And then in 1999, the oceans, the Pacific Ocean in particular, flipped back from its warm phase into its cool phase. And 1998 temperatures have not been exceeded since then. In other words, we've had no global warming in 12 years. The 1998 temperature was part of the result of an El Nino year, which is a warm equatorial Pacific current that tends to warm the global climates. And so what we end up with then is a period of global cooling, global warming, global cooling, and global warming in the past century. Four switches. And so there's nothing unusual at all about the period of warming that took place from 1977 to 1999. The interesting thing is that the IPCC, the International UN panel that is behind all of this global warming CO2 push, they have computer models that they use to predict temperature, and their models are used to predict catastrophic warming of 10 degrees Fahrenheit or thereabouts by the end of the century. And their prediction for the time period from the 10-year period from year 2000 to 2010 was an increase in global temperature of 1 degree, which is more than we've had for the entire past century. But that was their computer prediction. And in fact, we've had global cooling. So their models do not work. And if their models were wrong for only a 10-year period, then why should we trust them for a 100-year period? And the only test you have of whether a computer model is valid or not is to check it against real data. And when you check it against real data, the computer model shows that it has failed. So that's the short-term story for the past century. And then for the past 500 years, I calculated the paleo temperatures for oxygen isotopes in the Greenland ice core, and the result was interesting. It showed that there were 40 temperature changes back to the year 1480, in other words, about 500 years, warm, cool, warm, cool, warm, cool, with an interval at an interval of about every 27 years was the average, so 25 to 30 years, which is the same as for the last century. So we're seeing the same pattern carried forward, and if you follow that pattern into the future, then the prediction would be that sometime after the year 2000, it should start cooling, and guess what? It's been cooling for 10 years. So that, in a nutshell, is at least part of the story for at least the explanation for warming and cooling over the past 500 years.
Okay, so essentially no role for human activities such as burning fossil fuels. We're looking at a natural cycle, which you identify with what you call the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or the PDO, which also has an Atlantic Ocean counterpart, according to one of your recent papers, the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. Could you explain the linkage then, and I know it's going to be a little complicated, but between, say, warming and cooling cycles, glacial advances and retreats, and what's happening in the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean?
Sure. One of the things that I've done, and one of the clues that became apparent about 10 years ago, and I started predicting global cooling in 1999, which just by coincidence happened to be the year the Pacific Ocean flipped from its warm mode into its cool mode and brought on the cooling. But the whole picture of global warming and cooling is tied to the oceans. The ocean water temperatures pretty much govern how the Earth's climate is going to be. And the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean have essentially two stable modes. One is warm and one is cool. And there isn't much in between. And they tend to flip back and forth like an on-off switch. And so when the Pacific Ocean switches from warm to cool, then the global climate follows suit almost immediately with global cooling. We've seen this, as I mentioned, four times in the last century. And so everything depends on what's going on in the oceans. In the Atlantic, it's much the same thing. There is what's called the AMO, which is the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. It's very similar. And there's also a similar kind of a relationship in the southern hemisphere. And there's a southern oscillation, all of which go hand in hand together. And so what I'm saying is that the temperature of the oceans is the determining factor in what happens to global climates.
Don?
And the ocean has... Yes.
Do you have any idea what makes that flip?
I was just going to get to that.
Oh,
and
I'm sorry.
to point out that there is a really strong correlation between what's going on in the oceans and solar fluctuations. And there is one curve, which you'll find on my website, which shows the southern oscillation. This is the southern hemisphere oceanic temperature curve, plotted against a measure of solar variation, which can be measured in a couple of ways, in terms of sunspots or in terms of the sun's magnetic field. And if you plot what's called an AP index, which is the solar magnetic field versus the southern ocean temperature changes, you get a graph that goes up and down with a fairly high frequency. And it looks like two partners dancing together. The solar curve fits almost exactly on top of the ocean temperature curve. Having said that, we can say, okay, there's obviously a very strong correlation between solar variation and ocean temperature. We know the ocean temperature drives the climate. The climate is what makes the glaciers advance and retreat. So we can correlate all of these things very nicely. They all fit in together. All the curves fit together very nicely. But then when you ask the question, what's the mechanism whereby the solar variation affects the ocean water temperatures so quickly? And the short answer to that is we don't know. And instead of spending $9 billion a year with this CO2 nonsense, those are the kinds of things we ought to be investigating, because we won't know the real driving mechanisms and the mechanics of it all until we get a lot more data with respect to changes in the solar variability and the temperature of the oceans. So that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think that's very well concisely stated, and thank you. Especially the part about wasting money, $9 billion a year, I guess, on CO2 investigation, when we could be looking for the mechanism by which changes in solar magnetic intensity translates into changes in temperature in the oceans, which then drives this series of causal mechanisms that drive the climate system, not well understood yet, and yet we could be putting our money there. Let me just ask you, there's been a lot written and studied about El Nino, or sometimes called El Nino Southern Oscillation, which also has to do with temperature, water temperatures in the Pacific, especially. And it's a shorter term cycle of about, it's a very loose cycle, about 3 to 12 years. How does the PDO, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and the AMO, the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, do you have a sense of how these connect or correlate with El Nino Southern Oscillation dynamics?
Yeah, we do. There's a good record of that. And incidentally, any of your listeners can go online to the NOAA website, and you can get a global temperature image of the ocean water temperatures on a daily basis, taken from satellites. And what you will see on that is during a time of an El Nino. El Nino is a warm current that starts about is at the equator in South America, about off Peru or so, and it looks like a Geiger going across the Pacific Ocean, and the temperature is warmer, so on infrared it'll show up as an orange Geiger shaped figure going across the ocean. And it lasts usually about 2 years, something like that, and then the transition phase on either side, and then it's generally followed by La Nina, which is where we are right now. The El Nino of 2009-2010 is over, and it has now been replaced by a cold water system at the equator, following the same path. It starts in South America, off the coast of Peru, and now that warm current at the equator has been replaced by a cold current, and that's affecting our climates already, and it's going to give us another cold, snowy winter in the northern hemisphere land areas, almost certainly. It's setting up to be particularly strong this year. But at any rate, to answer your question, this is a short-term thing. Each one of these is about 2 years, three at the most, for both the El Nino warm current and the La Nina cold current. And what happens with respect to the PDO is that during the warm phase of the PDO, the warm El Ninos are favored, so there are more of them, and they're deeper, in other words, warmer. And then when the PDO, every 25 years or so, switches mode, say, into the cold mode, then there are more intense La Ninas, a cold period, than in the previous cycle. And so there's a direct relationship between the number and intensity of the warm and cold equatorial currents with respect to what the PDO is doing. Yes, they are related.
What about activity in the ocean vault that's volcanic? Does that have much of an influence?
It probably has almost none. You can't heat ocean water with volcanism, except extremely locally. We know this because you can look at submarine eruptions in various places of the world, and you look at the satellite photography, infrared photography of the water temperatures, and it's only warm in the immediate vicinity of the volcano and for a very, very localized area, and it doesn't really affect the nearby ocean temperatures at all. And in terms of atmospheric changes, if you get a really big ash eruption, like Pinatubo a couple of decades ago, then that puts a lot of stuff in the atmosphere, especially sulfur compounds and other things that tend to reflect a lot of energy coming from the sun. And so you get a global cooling for about 1 year or maybe 2 years before all this stuff settles out of the atmosphere. So the influence of volcanoes may be felt for a year, and then it's over, and then it's done. And so there's no protracted effect on climate by volcanic eruptions, only very short term.
Okay, so despite the fact that the media keeps telling us and the politicians keep telling us that it is warming and that it's our fault, in fact, if we look at the temperature data from satellites and as well as from instruments, we see that, as you mentioned, temperatures have been cooling off around the world, and in many cases, glaciers are starting to reflect that by advancing. In a sense, the politicians must be scrambling like crazy to maintain this illusion of warming, when in fact 2007, 2008 had very cold winters in which much of the warming that occurred between that warm phase, 1977 to 1999, was reversed. So could you tell us a little bit about what the glaciers are doing? There's all these hot-button propaganda, I would call them propaganda items that we hear. Sea levels are rising, glaciers are retreating, polar bears are dying, all this sequence of sound bites, which each of which I think is fairly easy to refute. But since glaciers are your specialty, can you tell us what the glaciers are doing around the world, Don?
Sure. And just a little history. During each of the warm-cool phases of the last century, the glaciers advanced during cold periods and retreated during warm periods. So we had glacial advances from 1880 to 1915, glacial retreat from 1915 to 1945, glacial advances from 45 to 77. Then glaciers had been retreating since about 1977 up until about 2000 or so. And it takes a little while for the glaciers to change gears, so it isn't instantaneous like it is in the ocean. It takes a little while for them to turn around. And so what's happening now is there are the glaciers, some glaciers in Alaska, I don't know about all of them, but some of them that I do know about stopped retreating a couple of years ago and have begun to advance. There have been glacial advances noted in Sweden and in Norway and in various other parts of the world. And as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation gets deeper into its cool mode, you can expect these glaciers and others, more glaciers, to stop retreating to begin advancing once again. And turning to the politicians for a moment, I have to chuckle periodically because the cooler it gets, the louder the politicians are shouting. And one of the things that they've been shouting is that the warmer it gets, the colder it's going to be. And they explain the really cold, record-setting, snowy winter that we had last year as being due to global warming. And if you can figure out the logic of that, let me know.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing is that sea levels are supposed to be rising, and they're going to be rising 20 feet. Al Gore has stated that by 2015, sea level is going to be 20 feet higher than it is now, and all the coastal cities are going to drown. In fact, sea levels are rising have been rising at a rate since we came out of the ice age about 500 years ago. They've been rising about a foot a century, something like that. Maximum expectable, even if global warming continued, which it isn't, would be something like a foot and a half. So there's no big sea level scare. And I was just reading today an article which was put out by NOAA, who's supposed to be the big climate experts, about how there's unequivocal evidence now that this is going to be the warmest year ever and that we're all going to have a terrible catastrophe. Sea levels are rising, and we know that because of measurements made by ships in the ocean. Can you imagine measuring sea level when you're floating in the ocean? I don't know how you do that. So anyway, there's a lot of nonsense going on, a lot of lies. You can believe almost nothing that's in the media because the mainstream media, the major television network stations and the major newspapers, with a couple of exceptions, have all bought into this dogma, this almost a religious belief, that no matter what the data says, you've got to believe in CO2 and all the terrible things that are going to happen. And as it continues to get cool, they seem to be ratcheting up the loudness with which they're shouting, and have no answer whatsoever from any of the evidence.
Yeah, there is a lot at stake, apparently, because there's a massive propaganda blitz that's been going on for a long time. But just to go back to your point about the fact that the apologists for the alarmists for man-caused global warming, there's actually an acronym in one of my recent book purchases here called HIGWIG, which stands for Human-Induced Global Warming-Induced Global Cooling. And this is the incredible the reversal of all logic, saying that the present global cooling is a result of global warming, and yet that is what the politicians and many scientists as well are telling us. Now we really, I guess, at some point we're going to have to look at why the science has been so corrupted as to have the so-called experts. Telling us that black is white and cold is warm, etc. But you've seen this over the years. You've gone to many conferences where I'm sure you must have felt like kind of the odd man out because you were not coming to the politically correct decision Do you perceive, can you just comment a little bit about how that has been for you? I know I've talked to some of my other colleagues who say, well, Don Easterbrook's been, you know, holding the, he's been trying to talk about these cycles in the face of even the scientific organizations being politicized.
That's true. And the bottom line of all this, it's all about power and money, both for the scientific people involved and for the politicians that are involved. And we can get back to the politicians and cap and trade and trillions of dollars that they're going to stick in their pockets a bit later, if you like. But as far as the scientists are concerned, if you look at what has transpired in the scientific world, for example, if you take, say, East Anglia scandal, where the data was doctored and there were emails about suppressing data and trying to keep any kind of global cooling from being published and taking over of the peer review mechanism so that they could control what gets published and what doesn't. It's all about money. And just to give you a few examples, Al Gore, for example, reportedly has made $100 million since he started his campaign, and he has several billion in his treasure chest, reportedly. There is the case of the East Anglia director, name is Phil Jones, who received $26 million in grant funds, pushing the CO2 thing. The chairman of the UN committee, the IPCC, Vachari, who's an Indian, has been spouting the demise of Himalayan glaciers, just as one example, going to make for extreme water shortages in Asia. And his basis for that was some pamphlets, some articles written by non-scientists in various activist organizations. And he used that to leverage money. He has apparently made millions of dollars. And he is also a shareholder in the Chicago Climate Exchange, apparently, reported on the Internet at least, where he stands to make perhaps billions of dollars if he can push cap and trade